or Gilmore and say that we're very privileged to have George Gilmore to speak to us here tonight. He's going to advert mainly to the activities of the Republican Congress in the 1930s. Afterwards, you will have an opportunity of asking some questions. I'm sure that when you confine ourselves just to the Republican Congress, there may be one or more things that you'd like to know, to learn from George or from Paddy O'Donnell. As I said, we will be very privileged to have us also here tonight. So I'll ask George now to read the paper that he's been good enough to prepare for us. George Gilmore.
The subject of the Republican Congress of the 1930s could only be discussed adequately in, at the very least, a large volume. I'm long past trying to do that, so all I can offer now is a very slight sketch of events leading up to it and of its eventual failure. If any of you are sufficiently interested to ask any questions, I shall do my best to answer them. First of all, we can't possibly understand the subject of this, the Republican Congress, unless we take a look backwards to its historical development, to the development that produced it, really. In other words, a sketch of the period leading up to it. And it all goes back, really, to the founder of the Republican movement in Ireland, and to the way his teaching has been changed, misunderstood and distorted by good people with a very different view to his view. When in the year 1791, Tone founded the United Irish Societies and set out to break the connection with the British imperial power, he did so on the basis of an analysis of the Irish political scene that, I think, would be accepted now as a Marxian analysis. He listed the different parties under the heading of the different religious sects that they very roughly represented. Protestant, Catholic and Dissenter, he called them, referring of course to the Northern Presbyterians as Dissenters. But he assessed their political potential according to the economic interests that they represented. He tried to get away from the old tensions and hatreds resulting from quite a big number of invasions through the centuries, and instead of making racist or cultural distinctions to induce the people of this island to take possession of their own country by working in unity under the inspiration of the new slogan of the rights of man in Ireland, the greatest happiness of the greatest numbers within this island. The inherent and indefeasible claims of every free nation to rest in this nation. That was the theme of the manifesto upon which the United Irish Societies were formed, and I needn't remind you it was at the time of the French Revolution, which was the bourgeois revolution against the remnant of feudalism. We are all fairly familiar with the very tragic story of the defeat of that great movement. I doubt if we all have noticed how quickly the clarity of that great vision faded out from subsequent Republican movements. There was very little of it left, even as early as the Young Ireland movement in 1848. And to point a little finger at that, I'd make reference to the present Republican flag, green, white and orange, compare it with the flag of the United Irishmen, which was all green, and you know the slogan around it, it is new, strong and shall be heard. Well now, to my mind, the old Republican flag represented the tone idea of republicanism far better than the tricolour that we use today does. We can say this for that tricolour, presented to the Young Ireland by the revolutionary forces in France in 1847 or 8, but still I think the symbolism of the old one is much better, because the old flag gave one political idea to the people of all the different sects without distinction. In other words, you don't need to be a Republican because you're Catholic or because you're Protestant, whereas the flag we use now makes the distinction. It uses green for a Catholic section, orange for the Protestant section, and then they have to be separated or joined, whichever way you like to put it, with a white space. So now, that's a good flag, but it's not as good as the old one, which more truly represented Tone's idea of political differences that there were, not being based on religion, but being based on class, really. That's a digression. There was little of it even as early as the Young Ireland Movement of 1848, little in the leadership of the Fenian Movement of 1867. Davitt tried to make it a driving force in Parnell's time with some little success, and it became only a shadowy memory in the early years of this century, until James Connolly tried to make it live again. Not, of course, in the context of the French Revolutionary period, but in the context of the class struggle of his own period. His great and very much misunderstood theme was the oneness of the struggle against national subjection and social oppression. It cannot, he wrote, be dissevered. Connolly was not the only one at that time who saw the Irish situation in that light. Roger Casement is known to us now for the love that he certainly had for the Irish language and its culture, but when he wanted to explain his reason for identifying himself with the 1916 rising, he sent a letter to the newspapers in Ireland and in the United States of America, and I think in England, in which he stated as the basic reality in the question between Ireland and England the fact that this nation was a subject nation, that its economy was a subject economy controlled by boardrooms not interested in the Irish people but in the production of cattle for the British market. You can see that letter still in some of the papers if you look for it. Through his knowledge of the top tier of the political structure, Casement arrived at the same conclusion expressed in the old popular slogan, "The land for the people and the road for the bulls." After Connolly and Casement and the other leaders of the rising had been disposed of, that clear understanding of political realities faded very quickly from the picture. If the rising had ended in victory, some at least of those leaders would have supported Connolly in his plans for changing the shape of Irish society. But that vision was missing from the new leadership that emerged at reorganisation, although they continued to use the name Republic with enthusiasm. Griffith's anti-working class and non-Republican mind dominated the struggle right through the Black and Tan War, through the Black and Tan War and the newly proclaimed Republic. Austin Stack, who remained to the day of his death and in transit in Sinn Féin, has left it on record that he used the IRA during that war to protect the landlord-rancher interests against encroachment on their estates by landless men trying to substitute people for bullocks. It was not a great wonder that enthusiasm for the Republic were weakened and confused when the people are offered what was described as national independence under another name. It is a fallacy to say, as current mythology tells us, that the people of Ireland voted in May 1922 against the Republic and for the Free State. That issue was not put to the people until after the Republican forces had been defeated by the British artillery. It was put then to the people of the 26 counties only in an atmosphere of military terrorism. But before that, they were sufficiently confused by what Madame Markievicz recognised as imperialism working by a change of names to allow Griffith's coup d'etat to succeed. "Is it the capitalist interest in England and Ireland," she wrote, she said rather, it was in a dull debate on Griffithite settlement, the capitalist interests in England and Ireland that are pushing this treaty to block the march of the working people in England and Ireland. Madam Marchewicks were referring to deliberate trickery by the pro-empire leaders of the Free State, but there was a change taking place that was not the result of any deliberate trickery. Patrick Cleese was taking over from Tone as the inspiration of Republicans. It was natural that Pierce, who had headed the rising, should become the great heroic figure in the popular mind. Unfortunately, he did not share the forward-looking views of Tone and Connolly on either Irish or world politics, and there were times when he seemed to think that all that was required was that people should be willing to die for Ireland, or even to be eager to die for Ireland. But then Connolly's teaching had not got any very widespread audience and had not influenced to any extent even the Labour leaders who succeeded him. And Pierce's romantic hankering after a long-dead Gaelic past did form a wonderful screen for Republican leaders who were working towards the compromise with imperialism that came to be known as Document Number 2, a recognised national identity, or, as Gandhi's representative in Ireland in 1932 put it, after he had had an interview with Mr. De Valera, a kind of nationalism that is not anti-imperialist. He said that to his amazement, Mr. De Valera had evolved the kind of nationalism that is not anti-imperialist. That was old Mr. Patel. Griffith's party had, of course, abandoned even the name Republic and had become simply the expression of the pro-British unionist and Redmanized well-to-do sections of Irish society. The Fianna Fáil party came to power eventually as the expression of the smaller farmers and working classes generally who were Republicans, however vaguely it was stated. Fianna Fáil then slithered down with increasing candour into the attitude towards empire that was expressed in Document Number 2. The symbols of subjection were to be removed. The economic structure of capitalism was not to be upset and was to be defended, however deviously. That document accepted matters of defence, peace and war, and political treaties as the common concern of Ireland and the Empire. The Fianna Fáil leaders, though they refused to follow Griffith in his really logical recognition of the British Crown, held to Griffith's economic policy to the attempt to develop an Irish capitalist economy behind tariff walls, and in due time they found that their efforts clashed with the British determination to keep control of this country as, among other things, an important part of their military defence plans. The crunch came in the 1950s when the mass was faced with a demand from the Anglo-American power bloc that he should give up the attempt to create an Irish economy independent of Britain and should agree to go along with the defence plans of capitalism in Europe. The pressure came through the Marshall Aid Authority, which had advanced free loans without strings, of course, to the Dublin government, and which, after the money was spent, changed by act of the United States Congress the terms governing those loans and demanded now acquiescence from John Lamass in their political and military planning. What had been the Economic Cooperation Authority became the Mutual Security Authority. The name even was changed over their office in Dublin and put special emphasis on military defence. Much of the loan money had been spent paying for equipment from the United States, and it was explained to Lamass that under the new law, the goods which could not be supplied, the goods that he had paid for out of the loan could not be supplied unless he agreed to their new terms. Charles Mass made strenuous efforts to persuade the Chambers of Commerce to come to his support, and, of course, they refused. Lamass who never dreamed of taking the plain people of Ireland into his confidence, found some formula for his collapse, and the Free State Agreement with the Free Trade Agreement with Britain was the result. And then the entry on Britain's tail to the EEC. Where, you will ask me, does the Republican Congress come into all this? The answer is that the Republican Congress was an effort to bring back to the name Republic its old meaning and to set the nation on a course leading to real independence, not just to a recognised national identity. But why the split in the IRA on the issue of the Congress? The IRA in the 1930s reflected within itself all the confusion of ideas that I have been trying to indicate, and its leaders were attempting to maintain its organisational unity at the expense of clarification. Heather O'Donnell, with some supporters within the army leadership, tried for years to persuade the army to take a stand on what could be described as a Tone-Connolly basis. In 1933, he urged the army leadership to use the influence that, at that time, it still had, to rally the disrupted Republican masses on the high ground of the Republic in a Congress that would restate the terms of the national struggle on a basis of activities through which the Allies of imperialism in Ireland could be isolated and exposed. A second attempt was made a year after, in 1934, when the rising tide of blue shirt fascism was becoming apparent to everyone. The attempt this time again was blocked by the GHQ staff's refusal to cooperate, even if the delegates to the convention agreed to it. The attempt was And a group of IRA officers then, and trade union officials, and Cumann na mBan, and others, went to Athlone, and from a meeting there, issued a manifesto calling for a Congress of Republicans. I shall read the manifesto as the easiest way of presenting its content. If I'm not taking the long... The manifesto that was issued calling the Republican Congress. We believe that a republic of a united Ireland would never be achieved except through a struggle which uproots capitalism on its way. We cannot conceive of a free Ireland with a subject working class. We cannot conceive of a subject Ireland with a free working class. This teaching of Connolly represents the deepest instinct of the oppressed Irish nation. The fight for freedom in our day has been weakened by the failure of the workers in the North East to see that their freedom is inseparable from the national struggle for freedom. Now that deep wages of workers there are freeing themselves from the illusions which so long held them in bondage to their imperial exploiters, the national issue must be brought sharply forward. On the other hand, the Republican movement in the 26 counties must see that Irish capitalism is the holdfast at this end for the imperial connection, and that the forces which defend Irish capitalism are the forces which, in the final push for freedom, will be called out to maintain the connection with an economy of British lives. The lip service paid to the Republic by leaderships that are tethered to Irish capitalism can therefore only confuse sincere Republicans and withhold them from the struggle for freedom. Such organisations steadily dwarf the national demands. It was such an organisation that reduced the Republic to the stature of Document Number 2 in 1921. It was a government based on such an organisation which, when the British challenged the sovereignty of this nation on the annuities, met the challenge not by raising the Republic and rallying the people, but by waiving British Acts of Parliament and by a parade of lawyers. This retreat from the public was not, unfortunately, resisted by those organizations which could have rallied the people on the high ground of the Republic. Had the IRA leadership understood that the economic war was not being fought to free Ireland, but to save Irish capitalism, they would have carried out this mobilisation first, before giving any support to that war. On account of their failure, the Republican issue has been pushed farther into the background. This mistake must now be remedied. A Congress of Republican opinion must now be assembled to make the Republic a main issue dominating the whole political field, and to outline what are the forms of activity that move to its support. Into this Congress will come anti-imperialists from North East Ulster, representing sections of workers who have hitherto held aloof from or have even been hostile to the national struggle. The areas of recruitment for Republican forces in the south of Ireland are: 1. Industrial workers who are being dragged into degrading working conditions to found a factory system at a time when the experiences of Europe and America are there to warn us of the horrors ahead. In impact areas which must be in close support of the Irish working class, the waste of confining this youth in among rocks to dig with spades and to face the horrors of migratory conditions is becoming too clear to an ever-widening area of Gaeltacht minds. The Gaeltacht youth must best help to tumble the walls and get free access to the broad ranches. Small farmers and petty traders are strongly represented in Republican organisations, and here is urgent work. For this section of the nation can only free itself as the ally of the working class. The land permission will never be abolished and the road open to the ranches except when a revolutionary government of workers and small farmers has achieved power. Only under such a government can this present civil service be dismantled and rebuilt from its lower ranks and wages related to what general conditions in field and factory can afford. As the Republic when established will be a Republic of the workers and small farmers, the forces that will achieve it must be drawn from those sections of our life. In order that these forces may be drawn forward to their task, we on their behalf call for a Republican Congress and pledge ourselves to take up the work necessary to build it. Well, now that was signed by a long list of names that I needn't read. They belong to all the sections I have mentioned, IRA, trade union officials, Cumann na mBan, and I don't see any others, but they're in the list, I don't know. Anyway, well, when that Congress came, there was an encouraging response to that call, and the work began immediately of organising Congress groups to put it into effect. Tenant leagues in the cities, land agitation groups in the rural areas, unemployed workers groups, etc., north, south, east and west. There were supporting calls from trade union leaders in Belfast, Dublin, Mullingar and other places. And by the same token, there were interesting lists of trade union leaders. They weren't only sham. I have them here if anybody wants their names. We had some exciting successes. When Moses Town Day came along, three busloads of Shankill Road workers marched in the procession, carrying a banner inscribed, "Break the Connection with Capitalism." Incidentally, before they went to Bodenstown, they laid a reed on the graves up in Arbor Hill of the 16th men. And on the next 11th of November, Armistice Day celebrations in Dublin, about 2,000 ex-British servicemen marched, wearing their war medals, under a Republican Congress banner calling for freedom for this small nation. some of you are too young to know that freedom for small nations was a British slogan in the 1914-18 war. The Communist Tenant Leagues made a very big impact on in Dublin, and they led to an immense improvement in living conditions in many of its worst slum areas. And still, when the Congress met in Rathmines, the forces it had rallied did not hold together. Most of the trade union officials who had come to the Congress withdrew. The Congress was coming in for ferocious attacks, ranging from fire and brimstone from heaven to animal gang razor blades. When the delegates met in Rathmines, they passed through a picket at the door of blue shirts, not wearing the blue shirt, but carrying banners calling upon God to save the Pope. The Pope was actually the words on that banner. Well, now that attack from all those quarters had something to do with the fact that a lot of the trade union representatives got shy of the Congress. They wanted to leave. They didn't know these, by the way. They made different excuses, of course. One Congress group secretary wrote in announcing his withdrawal. He said, because we had deserted the Workers' Republic, and then he added that he had decided before the Congress met to withdraw anyway, because his parish priest had told him that we were all communists anyway. So you can have it either way from that letter. That he would never have supported the Congress if he had realized that we were against God and Fianna Fáil. You can find some reason for it. The big issue upon which it divided really was that those who withdrew wanted to form a new political party. That would have defeated the objective of the Congress, because it would have left the mass of Republicans following the Fianna Fáil leadership. They wanted at the same time to use the slogan Workers' Republican Party to dodge behind when they left the Congress. So the Congress struggled on anyway after they withdrew. Mind you, some of the big unions even didn't withdraw. I don't think it'll be quite time, but it's a pity if you think that only a few people came from trade unions. That was not so. The three big labour unions in Dublin, the Workers' Union of Ireland, the Irish Transport Workers' Union, and the Amalgamated Transport Union, their leaders all told us that they hoped the Congress would succeed, but that they were not going to endanger their unions by affiliating the unions to it until they saw how it was going. But they said they'd make it easy for their members to join the Republican Congress, or for their branches to join as branches. And a great many of their branches did join. And besides that, the Seamen's and Port Workers Union, which is a big union, an important union in Dublin, is affiliated to Congress as a union. And there were other smaller trade unions also affiliated as unions. So it wasn't really, I'm not trying to make it appear bigger in that way than it was, but they really were getting shy of it. I'm afraid that that is the real conclusion to come to, and they found the excuse that there were two resolutions brought to the Congress from different groups within its bureau. And mind you, the Congress Bureau at the time, its governing body, wasn't only a few of us who called the Congress together. It had these important trade union delegates sitting at the table as part of the bureau making the rules for the Republican Congress. there's no shame about it in that way, but some of them remained on after the break, but most did not remain on, and the resolutions that were argued at the Republican Congress was one that came from a majority of the bureau calling for a change in the slogan under which we worked, to change it from being "On to the Republic" to being "The Workers' Republic" as opposed to "The Republic." Well, you see again, the objection to that was that that again leaves Fianna Fáil leading the mass of Republicans in Ireland, whereas "On to the Republic" passes out Fianna Fáil in those people's minds and brings them along, and then the activities taking place would make the cleavage with the capitalist system complete. But the reality was that the break took place because the same group who wanted that change in the slogan also wanted to stop the United Front shape of the Congress, to change it and become a new party. Well, that was a step backwards. It's easier to see that as a step backwards. We probably could have come to some agreement or compromise anyway on the slogan of action, maybe. But there was no compromise could be made on that question of forming a new political party among all the other political parties. That only meant isolating another group of people from the mass of Republicans, and it was useless. It was really on that issue, and those frivolous letters, at least that's the way meant to be frivolous, but they sound frivolous, that I read, they only represent the side of it coming out that was there in most of the people all the time too. The Congress struggled on for a couple of years, and as the Spanish War developed, the savage attacks became worse and worse all the time, and the Congress, by degrees, partly for that reason, and partly because the trade union people and other people were afraid to come near us under those attacks, and the Congress did a thing that I think most political organizations don't do. It announced that it was coming to an end, and we advised the people to go on with the same kind of work in whatever party they choose to go into, the Labour Party or any other. We wound up in that way, but still the Congress was a failure. The name of the Republic had not been saved from the degradation into which it was being brought. The right wing of the IRA found its way to an alliance with the remnant of O'Duffy's blue shirts and with Hitler's brown shirts, and eventually it was the blue shirt leader Costello who tried to outdo Mr. de Valera in popularity by renaming the 26 county state the Republic. That is about all it means to most people now, that name. It means the 26 county state as opposed to the six county state. It means very little else to most people. And the reality of the money lord grip, now centred in Brussels, is with us still.
George, in spite of its short history and its short range of activity, did it leave any positive relic? Did it leave any results at all in the thinking of the Republican Party?
I don't know. It left results in the thinking of some people, but it didn't bring any change in any Republican organizations. But the one thing that it did that is a result is it gave the party in power, the Fianna Fáil party, the idea that the slums in Dublin were really so horrible that they'd have to be changed. And they, as soon as the Congress closed down, the Fianna Fáil paper, the Irish press, began publishing reams of statistics about the slums that I gave them, actually. We had lots of statistics. They began publishing those, and that clearness of the slums was taken up by that party, and I think it has resulted in an immense improvement in Dublin. I know lots of you say there's lots wrong with Dublin still, and I know there is, but if any of you knew what the slum tenements were like 50 years ago, my goodness, I remember when a fairly big family in one room in a great high tenement house with only one lavatory down in a yard below, one water tap down in the yard where every drop of water had to be carried up 5 or 6 flights of stairs. One family in one room was so common that you wouldn't notice it. But it was pretty common. There were thousands of people in Dublin living at that time, 2 families to one room. They used to have a line stretched from one corner of a room to the opposite corner, and a screen made up of newspapers pasted together, and one family's home was in that corner and the other family's home was in that corner. That was there were numbers, I forget how many numbers there were. If you ever wanted to read that book, if you can find it, and find it in a library, I gave a lot of statistics about that in that book. It's, but really, at that time, Dublin was, the slums in Dublin are unbelievable. They were worse. The death rate in Dublin was higher than it was in any city in Europe. Moscow was next worse. That was before the revolution. But at that time, the death rate among working class people was next worst in Moscow, but worse in Dublin than in any city in Europe. And I think it was even worse than Calcutta, which was very bad. I forget to tell you the truth. Calcutta came pretty close to it, to Dublin's rate, either above it or below it. I'm not sure which, but they were pretty close. But they were terrible simply, but they're not like that now. Only real result. I'm sure that people got ideas into their heads, a few people perhaps, but there were things taking place then that were so big that they'd really be forgotten. You see, the Spanish War was on as a prelude to the fascist, anti-fascist war in Europe. And, well, that the war and the, I say not most of this out of people's heads, but the one concrete result of that thing about the slums.
Did Jim Thomas Party ever give the Republican improvement of society any degree of satisfaction, and so for how long? And the second question is, if you consider that the power of NATO is so strong at the moment, are all our governments powerless to change the course of it?
Well, I'd like to answer both of those questions. The first is, if Fianna Fáil ever gave satisfaction to Republican movements, depends on what you call Republican movements. About half the people in the IRA at the time had Fianna Fáil mentality. Whether they realised that or not, it is true. For instance, Sam Russell, who never joined the Fianna Fáil and who went into that tangle among the Nazis afterwards, he was a Fianna Fáil minded man up to the very time he started that bombing campaign in England. Just before that started, he told me, he was trying to get me to go into it with him, he told me that he was confident that Mr. De Valera would secretly approve of that bombing campaign and would allow them to use this place here as a base for it. He told me that De Valera would have to pretend he didn't approve of it, but that secretly he would approve of it, because Sam really still thought at that time of De Valera as the leader of republicanism. he was the leader of most Republicans. But there it was, even in the IRA, it was there. Well, now the other question was, well, that's an interesting question, because when the mass was under pressure from the Anglo-American power bloc, NATO came into that story. And you see, the pressure was, among other things, that for the mass to agree to support the politics and the military defense of capitalism in Europe, and the Americans being enormous, of course, of the Anglo-American bloc. But one thing that was put to the mass was about NATO, and the mass told President Kennedy that he couldn't join NATO because by doing so he'd be underwriting the border in Ireland. And Kennedy's answer was, we don't want you to join NATO. You're far more useful to us if you stay outside us and support us from outside. And that's what happened. And now, mind you, I don't know whether all of you have seen it or not, but the NATO thing, in that disguised form, is very, very well in the picture again. And as Mr. Lynch said, and various of those semi-government people and government people have stated, that if they build an economic structure, naturally they will defend it. Whereas by building the strength, the money lords are building the big power in Europe now, and certainly they defend it, they make us defend it. And General Haig, when he was put in charge of NATO, his commander-in-chief now, when he was put in charge of NATO at first some months ago, he told an interviewer that he was asked what was the principal problem of NATO in Europe. And he said that Europe, the ordinary people in Europe, are in for a disappointment. They have been encouraged to think that their lot will be improved under the EEC. But now he said it's not going to be improved. And our principal job in NATO forces is to see that that disappointment does not bring about political changes in Europe. Well, now that was, you'd find that a few instances of it just in the Irish Times some months ago when General Haig was. So there'd be never any fuss made about it, but that was about as candid a statement as ever I saw anywhere. And I say we, I mean the government. Yes.
A few hundred people from the Schenken Road to come down to Bodenstown.
Because we had good branches in Belfast for a while, the Hunting College branches, which included Schenken Road men as well as Paul's Road men, and that was a reality. I could read to you, there was much interest in that, the names of some of the trade union leaders in Belfast who support the Republican Congress, who issued a supporting call, and they were men with a real standing in the trade union movement in Belfast. It wasn't as strong as we would have liked it to be, but it wasn't phony. That's how they came. And I might tell you that the IRA leaders at the time ordered some of their units in Bodenstown to attack these men because they had an unauthorized banner at the parade. The unauthorized banner they had was a big Congress banner. I think, I forget whether they had the name of the Congress on it or not, break the connection with capitalism. They weren't allowed to carry an unauthorized banner, so they were attacked. And whether they took that as an insult or as a compliment, you could take it either way. I don't think it was totally an insult.
You referred to the slogan, On to the Republic, and the fact that you objected to the slogan, the Workers' Republic, because this would leave the masses under Fianna Fáil's leadership. Now, what I want to ask you is, if you had the slogan "On to the Republic" and Fianna Fáil had the slogan "On to the Republic," I agree with it as a slogan.
Well,
but what were you going to do?
The Republican Congress aimed at opening people's minds to the realities of the thing by activities.